You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 1st, 2022. Can't believe it's December. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Beatrice Adler-Bolton, healthcare advocate and author of Health Communism. Meanwhile, the House has overwhelmingly voted to force a contract between rail workers and the freight rail carriers while passing another bill that would give workers 7 sick days along much slimmer lines. Both will need to pass the 60-vote threshold in the Senate for that sick leave to actually stand, and there are some deep concerns about that prospect. The Fed is indicating that it could slow rate increases as inflation begins to slow. This comes as jobless claims fell last week. Rental prices have fallen slightly for a third straight month. And gas price averages are where they were before Russia's invasion of Ukraine. A majority Republican appointed Fifth Circuit judge panel has rejected the Biden administration's appeal to a ruling that squashed its student debt cancellation. So on to the Supreme Court it goes. But don't worry, at least we're adding billions more to the defense budget, most likely. House and Senate negotiators have agreed to add $45 billion the defense budget for fiscal year 2023. Again, no money for Medicare for all, college for all. Right. Republicans are worried about Herschel Walker's chances in the runoff election next week, partly because he took 5 days off for the Thanksgiving holiday. This would have been the year to maybe just skip your vacation. You're in a tightly contested Senate race, but hey, I'll take it. They're also worried because another former girlfriend of Herschel Walker's has come forward with allegations, this time about violence towards her. After nearly 4 years of trying, the House Ways and Means Committee has finally gotten a hold of Trump's tax returns. That could be interesting. The Republican Indiana Attorney General has instructed the state's medical board to discipline the doctor who provided that 10-year-old rape victim with an abortion. And lastly, all signs are pointing to South African President Cyril Ramaphosa being impeached. He would be the first president in the history of the country to be impeached. All this and more on today's Majority Report.
Oh, I got one.
Oh, what?
Washington, D.C. announced 2023 that buses are going to be free.
That's great.
Yeah.
Good for DC. All this and more, plus addendums from the great Matt Leck on today's program. Welcome to the show, guys. That's great news. I mean, public transportation.
Got to sprinkle in some good news in a day we're going to be pretty pissed off about a lot of things.
Well, here in New York, at least we're prosecuting people that jump turnstiles,
which is cool to do.
And yeah. Fall asleep on the subway.
I mean, come on. Couldn't be a worse crime. You know, a lot of interesting stuff happening in the news. I think in the fun half, we will get more into, like, the FTX drama, because we have to have Matt Binder here for that, for sure. And that's, you know, one of the most interesting stories around right now, if not for what we're seeing with the rail strike and the rail contract that's being imposed. Oh, yeah. And so, just to recap, the House has passed two resolutions, one breaking the strike, which passed overwhelmingly. Only 8 Democrats opposed it. Only one squad member,
Rashida Tlaib.
Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez changed her vote.
Tlaib had the right position, which is like, if you're going to be the party of working people, you need to show up for them every time. And every time would include an important, vital, like historical time like this.
Yeah, and she, that was the right vote. And like, so she was the only 1 of 8. Everyone else.
And it's concerning because, like, it, to me, it seems like AOC and Ilhan, for instance, could have voted with Tlaib and it still would have passed.
I just wonder why there must have been something, because there, it's recorded on the docket that Ocasio-Cortez in particular changed her vote from nay to yay.
There's only so many times like politicians have like there must be something before you have to show results for what that something is.
Right? And like what bothers me most about this is that it's so clear what's happening here. The splitting of these two bills, it ends, in my opinion, the most likely path for there to be any real paid sick leave. What's probably going to happen is that the first bill that passed overwhelmingly, which is the one that's in favor of the rail carriers and of corporate America, because like apparently if there's a strike, there could be billions of losses per day because of supply chain disruptions. But hey, maybe just give your workers
that's why you
paid
give them
sick
what they
leave.
Want. Yeah, exactly.
and this is really, I mean, behind the times in the sense that, and I'll get into some of what Biden could do. They're like, this is behind 80% of the rest of the country in terms of what is guaranteed for sick leave. And because there are federal contracts involved here, I saw, I heard David Dayen say this, there's a possibility that if the second bill that guarantees 7 paid sick leave days does not pass, Biden could amend an executive order that Obama passed in 2015 requiring the 7 paid sick days for workers involving federal contracts. But Obama's executive order specifically exempted rail companies from that order. Biden could amend it potentially and say, hey, this is what has to happen. But given how he's positioned himself in this very debate, in this very conversation, the fact that he led the charge to force the contract, I have very little faith that that will happen.
No, he's, I mean, and Lauren Gurley on Labor Reporter for Washington Post tweeted out on November 30th, after some talk that progressive Dems could torpedo Biden's rail deal, the Congressional Progressive Caucus just issued a statement signaling that members will go along with Pelosi's plan to enforce Biden's deal and vote separately on Bernie's request to add 7 sick days. Now, we know this with the infrastructure bill.
Yeah.
This is why, like, in Left Reckoning, we gave Jayapal the bump steer of the year because of this sort of thing, which is like, okay. And also, I think we do need to zoom out a little bit, and because we're most competent and most comfortable criticizing, like, the squad and on this point. There's also a labor issue here, too, where, like, people are saying, like, the union leadership was, you know, sort of in cahoots with the folks who wanted to cave on this. And that's a bigger problem, and one that, like, as somebody who's not, you know, in a union, don't feel like super comfortable talking about. But I do want to note that there's a major difference between what union leadership is doing and what rank and file, where rank and file is. And that's a huge problem, too. And it's a mess.
And just to reiterate the point that, you know, you were touching on there, Matt, about the Progressive Caucus not necessarily understanding what they're dealing with here, or, I mean, honestly, caving for God knows what reason. The fact that they're going to be that they were fooled again in the House by the breaking up of the bills,
or thought they could fool us again.
Right.
Like,
that
they decided
too.
To give, like, they wanted to give themselves, like, and look, it does. The AFL-CIO leaders may say, like, you know, actually, you know, the squad was working with us in this. And it's like, that might be true. It's still not satisfactory compared to, like, where your workers that you represent are. And it's yeah, sorry to interrupt.
No, it's okay. My prediction, and I think it's just clearly the most likely outcome, is that the strike-breaking bill will pass, the 7 days of sick leave will not, because it's subject to the filibuster. And in the Senate, that's the what they serve as an institution. They are a filter from for direct democracy and ensure that the interests of big money are protected, and that's what they will do exactly, most likely in this instance. And if that happens, all pressure needs to go towards Biden with that executive order, amending it to include rail workers in that way. But it still is not enough. He should have just stayed out of it, allowed the strike to happen, because what he's doing is releasing the pressure valve on these freight rail carriers, undercutting the leverage that a strike would create for these workers who just want paid sick days. I mean, we are the only country of the in the metric of, like, there's 22 highly developed countries in the world that does not guarantee sick leave. You have Belgium, it's like at least 14 days. Other countries have at least a month. I mean, we're so behind the times on this. And the it's even more pronounced in the rail industry, in a way that also is especially jarring, because, like, basically they have to take vacation days and plan in advance for themselves to be sick. We just went through a pandemic, and they either lose money or have to take vacation days if they're sick with COVID or anything else that they could spread to people. It is so outrageous and behind the times, and a terrible precedent that the Biden administration is sticking its nose in here and forcing a contract. But here is how right-wing media is framing this, because, you know, they have the dressings of populism. Eric Bolling, he wants to be like, hey, the liberals condescend to you. We're for the working person. We're for the forgotten flyover country or the middle of America. We're not coastal elites. But here they have somebody on their program, a worker. Or is it an attorney for the rail workers?
Both. There's two. There's a retired rail worker and an attorney for rail workers.
Okay. Just look at how Eric Bolling immediately tries to shut down the conversation in favor of the rail industry, and not so much in favor of the rail workers.
Well, the bottom line is that's all sounds well and fine, but the railroads are making record profits and they post it all the time. So we're asking for literally
stop that. I can't do that. I can't do that, Eric. They allowed to. That's the American way. That's constitutional. They're not doing anything wrong. You're allowed to make a profit, even if it's a lot of profit.
Pause it. It's constitutional?
Yeah, clearly.
I did not know that the Constitution said, like, regional monopolies are the foundation of democracy, and you should be allowed to gouge your workers. Oh, wait, there's no amendment to the Constitution that says that. The Constitution does not even say anything. I mean, it talks about commerce and such, but it's not like, well, we are a capitalist country, baby, let's go. There's nothing in there about that.
Some people would argue that that's what Jefferson meant when he said happiness, but I would disagree with that.
That's funny, but, like, even by the most, like, strict reading, I have no idea what the hell Eric Bolling is talking about.
Before we go back, I just want to make clear throughout this clip that, like, you know, besides all the reasons we know Bolling to be such an odious guy, he's just such an asshole.
I know.
Like, he's just like this guy, this is a like, pedestrian retired rail worker that he's literally groaning at his response.
No, stop it. Yeah. Stop it.
Like, let your guest talk. You literally brought him on your show.
I mean, is Bolling trying to claim that, like, any
scrutiny of profits?
Any scrutiny of profits is unconstitutional?
Or is an infringement of people's right to profit.
Let's go back to the beginning, because it's just, there's so much here.
Well, the bottom line is that's all sounds well and fine, but the railroads are making record profits and they post it all the time. So we're asking for literally
stop that. I can't do that. I can't do that, Eric. They allowed to. That's the American way. That's constitutional. They're not doing anything wrong. You're allowed to make a profit, even if it's not a profit.
I'm not opposed to them making a profit, but we're literally asking for pennies on the dollar. That's what we're asking for.
And if enough people walk off the job, Eric, if enough people walk off the job and they can't move the stuff from point A to point B, they're going to have to do it on their own. But that's going to be their choice to increase your salary and your benefits if they want to. Bill, you got 30 seconds.
Thank you. The real issue here is treating people fairly. Railroads don't even, when they want to fire somebody, they don't have to have 50-50 on their evidence. All they got to have is one official come in and say there's a rule violation. Why the public should
Bill.
Care?
Come on, Bill.
Come on.
You came on your show. I'm a libertarian. I come from the business world. Yeah. I'm a free marketeer. You come on the show and you're trying to convince me and my audience, who I believe sides with a lot of my views, I hope they do, that you're not allowed to fire someone if you want to, if you own the business. That's insanity. That's the direction.
You don't fire somebody in a kangaroo court, Eric. That's the problem.
Hey, Bill, you fire someone if you can't make ends meet. If the union says all of our workers, like Eric Mallow and the rest of them, need to be 20% higher and they can't afford to do business, or they don't want to do business at that margin, they have the right to fire people in America until someone like you guys, no offense, get your hold on the American free market capitalist system and bring it down. But boy, am I thrilled that we're still holding on to it. I like you guys, like the discussion. We'll bring you both back again.
I don't think so. I don't have the soundboard by me. But
listen, Bill, I have a right to shit can your ass whenever I want, okay?
Man, why doesn't he embrace debate, Eric Bolling?
Seriously.
I mean, Eric Bolling is right. That about the way the government's set up, right? Like, it is constitutional to make giant profits because there's nothing in the Constitution that says you can't do that.
And he is right that it's the American way to crush unions. Yeah. When he says, I'm a libertarian, I come from a business background, like, that's the contempt that is just bubbling beneath the surface for everyone in, like, the white-collar sphere to unions.
It's tyranny of the boss. And also what these people don't want to continue to say is, like, they also want it so when they do fire you, there's not a safety net, so you have to get your ass back to work for a different capitalist.
Yeah, and I just want to, like, since Bolling did not give either the rail worker or the lawyer for the rail workers any opportunity to talk, he kept returning to increases in wages, and their initial agreement did have an increase in wages, but the reason that they want sick leave is for the reasons I described earlier, the fact that they have to take vacation time if they are sick, or if they are sick and can't come into work, they don't get paid for that. That's insane, especially coming off of a pandemic. Eric Levitz, who's one of my favorite writers to read because he just is... He does his research, and it's very comprehensive. Wrote about this in New York Magazine, and I just wanted to highlight this here. He asked this question here: why do these rail barons hate paid leave so much? Why would a company have no problem handing out 24% raises, $1,000 bonuses, and caps on healthcare premiums, but draw the line on providing a benefit as standard and ubiquitous throughout modern industry as paid sick days? Because those aforementioned increases were in the agreement that the unions ended up rejecting because there were not enough sick days. The answer, in short, is PSR, precision scheduled railroading. PSR is an operational strategy that aims to minimize the ratio between railroads' operating costs and their revenues through various cost-cutting and ostensibly efficiency-increasing measures. The basic idea is to transport more freight using fewer workers and rail cars. We've talked about this before on the show. They've cut down on their workforce significantly, and that's why they don't want to give sick leaves, because there's no redundancy.
McKinsey Institute psychopathy. Mm-hmm. That's what we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. And Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi are going to bat for it. And part of the squad helped them do that.
All this has worked out poorly for rail workers writ large. Over the past 6 years, America's major freight carriers have shed 30% of their employees. To compensate for this loss, staffing remaining workers must tolerate irregular schedules and little time off, since the railroads don't have much spare labor capacity left. And when those efficiencies are created, like, the reason that they want efficiencies is because that goes upward to stock buybacks, to executives. It does not trickle down. If they were to more evenly distribute what the profits that they were making, it would not be an issue for them. That's why it's less of an issue for them to give bonuses and raises as opposed to increasing the workforce, because it undermines their efficiency model, which is why they're able to take home millions and millions of dollars in like executive pay and stock buybacks and such. So and the problem too is that they're regional monopolies, so they can essentially do what they want. What Eric Bolling wants is for that to be naturalized and for it not to be in any way abated.
Yeah, scrutinized. I mean, this is a dangerous moment for the people who want to see bosses maintain power over workers, because it actually lays bare like how, I mean, you don't even have just think if like Republicans were more in control of any parts of the levers of power, the Democrats would be saying, well, elections have consequences. You should have voted for us harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. All right, guys. Well, with that said, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Beatrice Adler Bolton. And we are joined now by Beatrice Adler Bolton, a co-author of the book Health Communism, A Surplus Manifesto. You wrote this alongside Artie Vierkant. I hope I'm saying that correctly. But thank you so much for coming on, Beatrice. Beatrice is a health justice advocate and author of the aforementioned book.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Of course. So, there's probably a new story every day that fits into your guys' thesis for the book, but since we've just been talking about it for, the past 20 minutes, right now there's this massive fight over sick leave for rail workers in this country. I guess I'm just curious about your take on it and how, it essentially, there's so many elements of it that underscore all the points that you were trying to make in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. It's unfortunately a really horrific example of a lot of the arguments that we make and the history that we try to show, both of how workers are made disposable and how our workplaces are affected by ideas about illness and about disability and about sort of what we can afford in terms of giving people the time that they need to actually recover from illness or even go see the doctor. I think it's very telling that sick leave and also COVID protections in the case of the organizing around Starbucks has been really key in a lot of the labor movement developments that we've seen in the past year, because more than any other aspect of employment, I think the way that we treat health as a commodity, that's artificially scarce and rarefied and really only for people who are entitled to it because they've worked hard enough in order to afford good health insurance, you know, these are the kinds of frameworks that are in place. And a lot of the ideas of how we think about how healthcare should be delivered and who deserves healthcare in this country.
I mean, in this country, too, we had a our healthcare is not just commodified in like the way that it is a commodity and you have to purchase it, but just in the fact that it's like inextricably tied to capitalism, because healthcare, for the most part, for most people, comes through their employer. So it's another leverage point in this country for bosses, for corporations that they can hold over people. Because, hey, if you want your health care, you better work for this company and you better work this job, even if it's not necessarily something that you enjoy, makes you happy, or has like pays you sufficiently.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one of the most key components of actually how labor discipline even works, right? If we think about the amount of times that unions have to roll back some of their demands in order to maintain the same amount of health coverage year to year. Oftentimes, when we're talking about the circumstances of bargaining, we're talking about what's being given up in order to maintain these bare minimums that unions have fought for, you know, for decades to try and maintain. There's that classic Simpsons episode, which is like, you know, Lisa needs braces and Homer's running for union president and has to sort of decide, is he going to give up on the, you know, the protections that they've won due to like pressure to reduce costs and reduce costs for the employer, most importantly. And all of those costs that get reduced for the employer, what's really going on is that's being pushed onto the individual person. And that's part of actually really how the idea of health being personal responsibility is also perpetuated through the fact that it's not guaranteed outside of employment, through the fact that it's rarefied in this very specific way, especially with the kind of growth of gig work and the amount of people who work 1099 and contract work who are not full employees, like all of the delivery folks who are working for UPS. These are some of the biggest sort of moments, I think, where we see not just how, as you're saying, sort of healthcare is commodified, but the total landscape of health is commodified, down to even how we think of our labor power is really dictated by how we perceive our capacity to have health and actually perform work.
I mean, down to, yeah, you mentioned the individual responsibility piece of how our healthcare is framed, especially in the United States, that it's a private, I mean, even like Nancy Pelosi will talk about abortion as like a private interaction between you and your doctor, whereas like, no, healthcare should be, we should have a collective understanding of it. And then there's also this financialization piece where it's even evident in the term health insurance, the fact that the insurance element of it, it financializes it in a way that is like, when you step back and think about it, completely unnecessary.
Absolutely. And this is one of the reasons why, not only in the book, but also in the podcast that I co-host called Death Panel, we really advocate for, you know, pushing the left on healthcare beyond health finance reforms. You know, a health finance reform is a wonderful thing, something like Medicare for All, right, where you have this intervention at the payer level, where you're trying to sort of shake up healthcare in terms of making it more accessible by changing who is paying for it. But beyond just who pays for care, there are so many other places where we need to push our idea of care. We need to push our idea of what people deserve and sort of what dignity that we all deserve in our lives and what, you know, we want for the world. I think part of, you know, the limitation that we've seen for so long is that we've been really kind of limited to health finance reforms. It's been very difficult to get anyone on board with something, for example, like an American NHS, where you could also be working in terms of redistributing spatial resources and redistributing educational resources for people who are health workers. So this is the kind of advocacy that we've been doing for a long time. And in health communism, we really tried to show sort of what was some of the history behind past engagements with these ideas? How did some of these ideas develop? that help perpetuate things like private insurance or like the idea that the UK's National Health Service, the NHS, should be privatized to make it more efficient and better, in essence, which we know it won't.
I want to get into the NHS because I found your guys' critique of that to be really compelling. But I guess I just kind of want to start more broadly at the beginning because your opening sentence and the introduction is, quote, you know, healthcare or health is capitalism's vulnerability. And that's so central to what you discussed. Do you mind expanding on that point for our audience?
Absolutely. I think, unfortunately, as we've seen in COVID, we've seen a lot of demonstration in real time in the last 3 years of what this means, right? And in particular, I think a great example of this is what's happening in public schools right now, where you're seeing issues where too many people are sick at one time. And while this is happening in the context of a respiratory disease, respiratory diseases are just one experience of illness. There's so many other experiences of illness that we all move in and out of throughout our life. Even people like myself who are chronically ill and disabled, you go through periods of more debility and less debility, more chronic illness, less chronic illness, more capacity, less capacity. And these are things that are very ongoing and sort of transient, but we really often limit them to the individual patient provider encounter. And we limit the idea of health to this kind of aspirational framework of really health is more of an obligation. It's something that you need to live up to than it is an intrinsic quality about yourself. And if we think about, you know, all of the things that go into what we conceptualize as individual health, right? It's actually socially and structurally determined more than anything else. You need to have housing, you need to have shelter, you need to have access to clean air, to food, to water, to work that doesn't make you sick. And this is sort of broadly speaking, both in terms of the conditions of work, the kind of hours that you're working, the labor that you're expected to do on the job, but also how much time you're given to rest or what happens if you're injured. Are you supposed to work through it? So if we say, you know, someone is responsible for their own bad outcomes with diabetes because they work a job that doesn't give them enough time to go to the doctor enough to get on top of their blood work and maintain their insulin levels properly. You know, is that actually their responsibility or is this actually a collective responsibility that we've failed? And what we argue in the book is really this idea of health stands in for a kind of intrinsic quality or a personal characteristic that really masks the fact that capitalism and our bosses need our health in order for us to be workers at all, in order to even extract surplus labor value from our work and our toil and our labor, we have to, you know, have some capacity of health. And so there's a kind of contradiction that exists here, right? Where we're told our health is our personal responsibility, but capitalism would not work if we weren't maintaining our bodies in order to sort of be good workers. And if we even think about something so simple like what you do to prepare for a job interview, you know, make sure that you look like the best version of yourself possible, because what you're doing in a job interview is selling the fact that you're healthy to someone who might give you wages and healthcare in order for you to maintain that relationship. So the idea that it's personal responsibility and people's fault when they get sick is pretty ridiculous when you put it in that context.
And also that delicate balance there too, where it, you know, capitalism wants some base level of health for workers to be able to be productive, but not too much, right? Because it gives them a little bit more bargaining power based on the dynamic that, like, we discussed earlier. And so, I mean, the idea that healthcare is just like kind of existing in this natural organism and it's just an ecosystem that reproduces itself is so laughable when you put it in those terms.
Absolutely. And I think one of the best ways to see how this actually works is to look at the kind of healthcare that we give to people who are not workers, the kind of healthcare that we give to people who are poor, people who are, again, not working, the kind of jobs that are providing them with those high quality private insurance plans that people always say that they don't want to lose being the reason to not do something like Medicare for All, where instead of people having to compete for varying levels of coverage, we can give everyone equal coverage that's good, right? That's free at the point of access, and that doesn't place the kind of prerequisite of having money to spare and or the ability to take on medical debt as a kind of requirement for even engaging with starting to get some of your symptoms checked out. And so, you know, one of the things that we talk about in the book is this kind of false binary that exists between workers and non-workers, or workers and surplus. The working class and the surplus class are these two kind of dichotomies that, you know, they're two halves of the worker identity, right? Because workers are always at risk of becoming injured, of becoming maimed, disabled through work. And when you cross that sort of line, you face a level of state abandonment and forced poverty that's pretty extreme. If we're looking at welfare programs like Social Security Disability Insurance, or for people who don't have enough work credits, Supplemental Security Income, which is even lower and has much more draconian limits on how many assets you can have, or even something as simple as Medicaid, right, where you have people who are really policed and surveilled in exchange for the bare minimum care, which is also a mode of private profit extraction from the healthcare relationship. So what's being prioritized over and over, and what is really obvious in the care of people who are in the surplus class, is that what matters about our care is not the care that we receive or any therapeutic benefit. It's about how much it prepares us to be a body at work, and about what it can kind of do to make a better body politic of better workers. And when you move into the arenas where we're talking about caring for people who do not work, who are not considered contributing taxpayers, you see this level of austerity, divestment, and organized abandonment that is reflective of the fact that we value people according to their productivity and according to their economic position in the world.
So, is it possible to have truly socialized healthcare when the principles of austerity are so embedded in, like, every, you know, in our entire economic structure? Like, we want Medicare for All, 100%. But, you know, you guys argue this as well, where it's, there are going to be limitations to it within capitalism.
Absolutely. I mean, Medicare for All is still one of those reforms that people like Ruth Wilson Gilmore call capitalism saving capitalism from capitalism, right? The fundamental problem that Medicare for All is trying to fix is one of scarcity of resources in terms of, you know, how we're providing people access to the payer for health insurance, right? And if you're trying to sort of create some sort of ethical version of capitalism, then a health finance reform like Medicare for All would be transformational, but it wouldn't be revolutionary in terms of changing the political economy of health, in terms of changing this fundamental relationship that you have to your boss, where your health is used as a kind of disciplinary measure against you. I mean, you think of all the people who get fired for taking too many sick days because they've been forced to be exposed to COVID because of their workplace. You know, this is the kind of conflict that we've naturalized as a debate, a kind of culture war over whether people believe in COVID or not. But one of the biggest issues with COVID that kind of hides is that this isn't about partisanship. It's about people being forced to be sick, not having access to the kind of care that they need, and not being able to take that time off of work to even get better, right? So we're just perpetuating infections, we're perpetuating people's abandonment, debt, and bad health outcomes, all for the name of basically sort of maintaining this relationship of denying that fundamental freedom of being able to just get the care that you need, which is why the book's not called like ethical health capitalism or like, you know, gentle
or like
reforms.
What's realistic right now. It's more, you know, this is like, you know, I don't want people to get it twisted. You support Medicare for All.
Absolutely.
So do I. 100%. It would be a major improvement. But like, this is just like a larger critique, and it's a global one as well, I should say.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because we cannot really conceptualize a kind of world where people are getting the kind of care that we are advocating for, which is, you know, I think, best expressed by our comrade Tim Faust, who wrote a great book, Health Justice Now, a couple years ago. It's a great read, highly recommend. And Tim, you know, frames it as all care for all people. And that means care that has to pass through borders that right now we use to sort of restrict access for things. And so that's why in the book, we say that it's not truly possible to create a sort of liberatory anti-capitalist version of health that can exist within a capitalist island. If we want to actually try to make these changes and build a society that's led by workers and worker power, then what that is actually going to involve is not just a radical shift in our labor relations, but a radical shift in the way that we even think about health, from an individual phenomenon to a collective kind of population level idea of what happens beyond you and your body and out in the world. And this obviously also relates not just to things like COVID and workplace organizing, but climate crisis and the fact that we're going to be seeing a lot more migration as a result of what we've done to the environment, that's going to also shift where we need health resources. And places like the South, have seen in the United States such extreme divestment, and poor communities throughout the U.S. have seen extreme divestment as capitalism has further colonized the health landscape in the United States. We've seen things like pharmacy benefit managers really grow to this extreme level of being able to extract all sorts of rebates and refunds to turn everyone's pharmacy insurance benefits into a kind of profit extraction scheme for these third-party companies that are really just doing pass-through sort of contract work, right? And like, why do we have all sorts of people who are engaged in things like Medicaid estate recovery, taking people's homes after they die to pay for the care that we provided them? You know, these are kinds of resources also, and technologies and tools and human time that can be redirected towards so many other things. So if we want to actually go for, you know, ideas of how to make healthcare better, we have to actually think beyond the structure of the healthcare system, the hospital system, the health finance system, and look at some of the social and structural determinants of health beyond just that kind of idea of what healthcare already is.
And yeah, you mentioned how there's going to be an increase in migration as climate change makes its effects even more acutely felt. And, Matt, our producer, just wrote to me like that when you're not looking at healthcare from an international, like, cross-border perspective, it could easily devolve into the right wing essentially saying, you know, illegals are getting Medicare for all, and then we're back to a conversation about scarcity.
Right. And back to a conversation about who deserves healthcare and why, that we know is sort of fundamentally driven to try and limit who has access to healthcare, to try and limit who's part of the we that gets the benefits of everyone's work and labor and suffering, you know, through the kind of brutal landscape that we live in. And when we talk about, sort of these kinds of ideas like who deserves the COVID vaccine and how much countries should have to pay for it. You know, vaccine apartheid is the perfect example of why simple health capitalism reforms don't work, because COVID does not respect borders. If we're not going to provide vaccines to everyone equally, then we're not going to end COVID, right? And if Pfizer can operate at this kind of international level, then what the left needs to really do is start building our own international relationships and our own sort of organizing reciprocity so that we can start to build power at that level as well. There's nothing that we can do to sort of tackle the pervasive nature of the commodification of pharmaceuticals if we don't start approaching some of these like more internationalist frameworks, which haven't been as much of a focus of how we talk about healthcare. I mean, I as I've said, like, huge Medicare for All advocate. Like, we do Medicare for All week on Death Panel. We talk about this constantly. We end every show with Medicare for All now, solidarity forever. But the fact of the matter is that Medicare for All is a nationalistic proposal. It's a proposal that, you know, takes the U.S. resources and tries to maximize them within our borders. And I think that we can all do so much more than simply sort of saving ourselves and the people immediately around us.
Well, I mean, vaccine IP is just like spawn of hell. Like, I mean, it really is such an evil enterprise. I wanted to touch on your guys' critique of the NHS as well, because, you know, in the UK, for people who don't know, the NHS is their socialized healthcare system, but there are so many, there's a lot of pitfalls with the NHS. One is that it's vulnerable to privatization, which has been like the push for many decades by the right in the UK. And also there are things like trans care, which are there's a complete kind of hole in what's provided there. Can you talk a little bit more about that system in particular, and in comparison to ours and other socialized healthcare systems globally?
Absolutely. I think one of the reluctancies that people have is to critique some of the good things that we've won over the years, like the NHS from a global perspective. I mean, obviously not in the United States, but you know, I think people have a lot of attachment to things like the NHS, because when we talk about those kinds of reforms, like doing an American NHS, that's the kind of thing that if you say it out loud, most people are going to respond to you that that's not feasible, reasonable, possible, ever going to happen, you know. And so I think the inclination is to say, well, why bother sort of calling these things out for not being perfect if it's not ever going to be, you know, what we're going to get at all. But I think, one, that's a bad attitude that's already putting us on the back foot, right? It's already assuming that we're never going to be able to do some of the things that we want. And fundamentally, I don't think it's worth even thinking of things that way, which is why, you know, we push back hard on this point of sort of how are you going to pay for Medicare for All as being really beside the point. But when it comes to the NHS, I think we hold it up on a pedestal. We hold it up as this gold standard globally of, you know, one of the best examples of socialized medicine. I think this also happens with the Canadian Medicare system. It also happens with the Scandinavian healthcare system. And, you know, I think the question I have is, when we advocate for Medicare for All in the United States by saying we want something as good as the NHS, what does that do to sort of undermine what comrades in the UK are trying to do to make the NHS better, right? And this is something that we've seen also in disability policy, where the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a great policy, but is quite limited, is the gold standard globally for disability policy. So if the US's position becomes the kind of pinnacle of what we're going to do, and the Americans with Disabilities Act falls so short and fails so many people, then this is a pretty low bar to set as the gold standard. And I think, you know, in terms of the NHS, what we know is that when the NHS was designed, it was designed to include competition artificially because they felt it was necessary to drive innovation. These kinds of ideas have no place in a socialized medicine system. They have no place in any kind of reform that we should be holding up as a gold standard. And so it's really important to sort of name things for what they are, so that we can actually make sure that we're all on the same page in terms of our demands, and that when we advocate for something here in the US, we're not throwing friends who are fighting to make their health systems better under the bus with our rhetoric, because what happens in our country doesn't stay in our country. These things reverberate. And if we were to push for something like Medicare for All and actually really, you know, reject some of these frameworks about pay for, about austerity being necessary to the socialized model, then that would actually provide so much more fuel for Labour Party folks in the UK who are fighting United Healthcare coming in as the sort of American consultant company trying to privatize the NHS. There might be a nurses strike, a historic nurses strike in the NHS system this year. It's like on the verge of happening. I think the question we need to be asking ourselves is sort of in the US, like, how can we support what's going on in the sort of fight to, you know, make sure that the NHS is safe? Because right now people are waiting for 2 days for an ambulance in certain parts of the UK, and trans comrades are having to flee the country to get their hormones elsewhere as we're seeing things rolled back. And, you know, what I think we kind of are hoping to really propose with health communism, you know, it's not a roadmap or a plan, but it is a kind of way of looking at all these different systems and finding the common critique that exists throughout, which is really this kind of economic valuation of life driving how we design things, driving our priorities. And the NHS fundamentally is a system that still prioritizes the economic valuation of life, and that becomes its sort of ultimate shortcoming and undoing.
And you talked about disability rights, which I know is so central to your work as an advocate and a writer. Can you expand a little bit more on that topic in particular, and just the ways that these cracks become craters for people who are disabled, and healthcare being so commodified couldn't be more life and death, if you don't mind talking a bit more about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the ideas that we develop in the book and try and share with people is something called extractive abandonment. And to kind of build the case for how to know what this is and see it when you encounter it, because we all encounter it, not just disabled people. All of us feel this all the time. But a disabled person in a nursing home is a really good example of how this works. And so we build on things like the money model of disability, which is an idea from the Marxist disability theorist Marta Russell, which looked at kind of how, for example, the ADA was a very capitalist policy innovation. It was quite conservative. It was sold as being a great way to get people off of welfare and to enfranchise them as workers in capitalism when they had been sort of rejected. So what we kind of do on Deaf Panel and in the book is more like what Marta Russell does, where instead of looking at, you know, why is society rejecting disabled people, we're looking at disability from a political economic perspective, from the perspective of sort of what does disability do in the economy as an idea? What does disability do in policy as an idea? And part of what it does is often sort of mark and sort people according to how they can best be extracted from. And not a lot of people realize this, but many people of all ages live in nursing homes and long-term care facilities. It's not just people who are elders. It's not just, you know, people who are retired. It's also young people who cannot find accessible housing and have nowhere else to go, who are disabled, who often have to spend, you know, decades living in congregate facilities as a young person, right? This is sort of taking away someone's access to the social sphere, to a social life, to really being a part of society. And it has nothing to do with work. It has everything to do with the built environment, the political economy. So extractive abandonment is really a way to sort of name how, when we're looking at how disability policy or health policy is formed, where are the priorities sorting out? You know, what is being sort of attempted to be done even in some of these reforms? And a great example is, again, like nursing homes. So a disabled person in a nursing home becomes more valuable as just a body in a bed. They become an asset that can be traded on the stock exchange because this is an investment opportunity that is funded by federal funding. So when the federal funding from Medicaid will pass through that person into the likely a private equity company at this point who owns the nursing home, it's then up to the nursing home to make a profit from that person's existence. And that person's whole life becomes really subject to their commodification. But this happens in much more subtle ways, in the ways that we all engage with our own care, picking up our prescriptions in terms of, you know, dealing with your primary care physician, signing up for health insurance at all of these kind of ways that we maintain our bodies in order to be workers so that we're not abandoned, so that we're not turned into this sort of fully commodified resource for the state. You know, to maintain our kind of personhood, we have to maintain our bodies to a certain standard, an ableist standard of sort of what a healthy person is. And so, you know, the kind of lack of interest in providing affordable housing is not necessarily only reflective of like a society that doesn't like or appreciate disabled people. It's also reflective of a society that says that we can't afford anything other than the bare minimum. And if you want the more than the bare minimum, that's something you as an individual have to buy. So part of sort of what we push for is actually very different than disability rights, because disability rights is all about, you know, deserving civil rights on the basis of sort of identity. And what we're pushing is more of an idea of thinking about how disability is instrumentalized by capitalism, is instrumentalized against disabled people by the state, but is also used as labor discipline against all workers as a kind of threat of what's going to happen to you if you're unable to maintain your body according to those sort of minimum standards that we set out.
Well, Beatrice Adler Bolton, health justice advocate, author of Health Communism, co-author, I should say, Health Communism, A Surplus Manifesto. I'd encourage everybody to check it out. Thank you so much, Beatrice. Really appreciate you coming on today.
Thank you so much. It's been so fun.
Yes, for sure. And also check out Death Panel podcast.
Thank you.
Well. Yes. Yes, that too. All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks.
All right, guys. Well, with that said, we're going to wrap up the first hour, the free part of this program, head into the fun half where we will be joined by Matt Binder, Brandon Sutton. We'll be talking FTX, some other right-wing clowns, taking your calls, having some fun. The number is 646-257-3920. But first, Matt, what's happening in the MLU?
It's MLM now.
Oh, right. Okay.
But
I'm so sorry. I apologize.
Thank you. It's okay. Tuesday, we had Sam Goodman of La Ruta del Clima on to talk about the good news, some good news out of COP27, which I wasn't expecting, frankly. And he also wore the Left Reckoning hat in Egypt, which I really appreciated.
Oh, cool.
Sent us a selfie from that hellhole. We said it was not great vibes in Egypt, apparently, from the human rights situation and the just location of the conference, but some good news out of it. So check that out if you want to have some good news from the world on this bleak week. We also bitched about Joe Biden. Didn't have the full context of how Congress was going to handle it at the time, so you know, we'll be talking with This Is Revolution across stream tonight about that, which will be on the Left Reckoning YouTube and This Is Revolution YouTube.
Speaking of This Is Revolution, we should say, we should talk about this really quickly because Matt, the This Is Revolution guys, give them an argument, Ben Burgess and Left Reckoning, another crossover event. But Sam and I will
who
be
else?
There.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so this one's in New York, so January 22nd.
Yeah, I would say the, I think Ben, oh yeah, here it is. I'm going to send this to you, Bradley, in the group chat.
The
but
flyer.
Yeah, we're calling this tentative, sort of the AKA, it's give them a revolution, but also a leftist best fest. Yeah, I'll put this up here. It's going to be January 22nd at the Cutting Room in Manhattan.
In Midtown. So if
first time we did a Manhattan show.
Yeah, if I saw someone who tweeted and said, like, hey, can you get directions from Penn Station? Like, this could not be more convenient if you're coming from out of the city. It's on 32nd, and you could just walk a few blocks, and it'll be right there.
Yep, train our way in. So the tickets will go on sale. Bostka Sankara, Deep State Cuba, Jake Abbott, Jandrew World, also their full crew. And looking forward to it. There's also going to be a meet and greet section. So I like the live shows too, but it's more fun just to meet people and talk to them before the show. So buy your tickets, folks. January 22nd.
Oh, it's before the show, the meet and greet?
Ooh, I should maybe check that. It was before the show in L.A., but, I'll confirm that.
I'll be there, too, so that'll be fun. Can't wait. Check that out, guys. Get your tickets now if you do want to come. And then on ESVN today, Bradley and I will be giving our locks for this upcoming NFL week. There he is. I went 2-1 this past week and Bradley went 0-3. So here we go.
Ooh.
I'm roaring back. He went 0-6 the past 2 weeks and
brutal.
I've gained 3 games on you. So
how far are you behind now?
I got to do the math, but because he's had 3 pushes, which like we need to figure out how we're doing that. But I think only 2 games in terms of the win column at this point.
That's not enough, but
I just get stronger as the season goes on.
Right, yeah.
Because I get a better sense of these teams. I feel like this happens to me every
Emma's
year.
Locking in.
Oh yeah, baby. I do not want to eat cheese on camera. We want Bradley to have to eat peppers.
Stinky cheese.
Yeah. No. Oh, God.
You.
Oof. Anyway, we're gonna head into the fun half shortly. But do we have Binder and Brandon? Oh, yeah, youtube.com/ESVN show. We're live at 4 p.m. every Monday and every Thursday at this point. Hi, Binder. We're setting up the shot, so you're not on there. There you are.
There we go.
Hey, guys.
How's everybody doing?
Doing
great.
All right.
Refreshed. Uncentered.
Uncentered. Is that the new thing? You want to be uncentered?
No. I gotta like move over to the.
Oh, I see. You're
right.
I thought you meant in terms of vibe, but you mean in terms of cropping.
Yeah.
I was wondering where you were going with this, Matt.
So Binder, what's happening on your twin shows, Doom and Scam Economy?
Oh, yes, I know. I got two shows, and I'm going to be doing a third tonight, actually. Let me tell you all about them. Yeah. On Tuesday was a new episode of Doomed, which you could check out at youtube.com/MattBinder and at doomcast.com. I had on Alejandra Caraballo, who if you're on Twitter, you might know her as @squeer. We basically talked about, the current right-wing meltdown after the midterms and how they were promising to be different for a whole maybe quarter of an hour before going right back to the weird culture war stuff that turned everybody off of them and going after trans people and LGBTQ people in general. And we talked a little bit about how I've been going after every single right winger who used OK Groomer and how they seem to all apparently have ties with the Nexium sex cult. And one of Keith Raniere's closest lieutenants who helped groom victims for him, and they all defend this person. Very weird. Very weird behavior.
Weird.
Very weird behavior. If you go on Twitter, twitter.com/MattBinder, and see my tweets about it, you'll see a lot of people taking these photos and sending it to these right wingers who repeat OK Groomer to every person they disagree with over and over again. They are having an absolute meltdown about people literally showing them their own pictures of them sitting with this Nexium groomer.
HBO famous
allegedly
groomers. Right.
I mean, also, the one that's not Chloe from Smallville, which makes it even
she's in jail.
Less understand.
Well, she's in jail. This is the one who is married to her and also had a relationship with Keith Raniere and is the one who's leading the charge in trying to get the whole case overturned, claiming FBI maleficence or whatever. And
she's unrepentant too.
Oh, no, not only is she unrepentant, she's still in the cult and she is his strongest defender. HBO just released a part two of their documentary on Nexium. Ooh. The Vow. She is a main character in this. Ooh. Anyone who is completely apolitical and has watched this, if you look online, they think she's a scumbag. If you look at how she's, I haven't watched the second season yet. So she even looks bad in that. She allegedly, and this all came up in the trial against Keith Raniere, why they didn't charge her. I'm guessing maybe they didn't have enough evidence or she portrayed herself as a victim who is the person still defending him. I don't know. A lot of women have come out and said what this guy did to them. Some of them, by the way, as young as 12 years old, saying Keith Raniere groomed them. One claims that she had sex with him when she was 15 years old. I don't know what else to say, but this is who these people are defending. And they're not just defending the Battlestar Galactica actress who's doing all this stuff that I'm telling you about. She's the one in the pictures with them, Nikki Klein. She's the one who is defending him and helped groom sex slaves for him. They're not just defending her anymore. They have moved into claiming that the case against Keith Raniere, who's in jail for 120 years for trafficking and all sorts of horrible things, they're now claiming that he's innocent too. These are the people who call every LGBTQ person a groomer. I mean, I don't know what else to say. I mean, their shtick is done. it's done, and they are getting a taste of their own medicine. And I'm proud to say I had a big part.
And it's weird.
That.
It's weird too, because yeah. I saw one person be like, "They're just looking for any straw to grasp." Like, bro, this is the juiciest straw ever grasped. Like, this is
a picture
person,
of them together hanging multiple, out, and him saying, "Here's my friend."
No, multiple pictures, different multiple occasions, pictures. And
different occasions. Yes,
exchanges on Twitter, and I mean, it's gone from like a gotcha sort of thing to like, this is a concerning pattern and relationship that yeah. like actually I think implicates everything they've been doing publicly.
Wait, man,
and yeah, I gotta tell you it's not just James Lindsay, the OK Groomer guy, the guy who is melting down. It's not the people who've defended him. I've yet to unleash them all. Multiple photos of various right wingers over the years hanging out with Nikki Klein, the Nexium lieutenant in command to Keith Raniere, who still defends him to this day. I have multiple photos of these people hanging out happily. Like that's the thing too. They go, well, they were on a debate stage together. Yeah, and guess what? First of all, I want to just break this down for a second. You know what the segment that Nikki Klein was at for the debate? It was how you can't trust the three-letter organizations like the FBI. You know what her reason for being on that stage was? To claim Keith Raniere is innocent! To try to say the FBI planted evidence on him! What is her experience with the FBI beyond that? That is her whole connection to being on that debate stage. So if you were on that stage agreeing with her, like James Lindsay was, you were helping her try to get a convicted sex trafficker out of prison and try to whitewash what he did to literal children, 12 years old, 15 years old. And you know what? A shit ton of women who may have been 18 and over, but were lured into this and groomed to do. You should see some of the shit they made these women do. It is horrendous. It is one of the most disgusting stories I have ever heard. It's incredible. Real Nexium. NXVI. Oh, hold on. I'm messing it up myself.
NXIVM. It's a weird spelling.
Yeah.
NXIVM. Yes. It's pronounced Nexium, though. Please. Do not let this go to the wayside. This should haunt these people. They should never be able to walk in public without, because they you know how easy it would be for them to come out and say, you know what, I was wrong. I acknowledge now what this person. No, they are defending her and defending Keith Raniere still right now. And you know what? This debate, this hangout, their most recent hangout, James Lindsay, the OK Groomer guy, and Nikki Klein, their most recent hangout, was in April of this year. You know when Keith Raniere was convicted? In like 2018, I think he was jailed then in 2019. This has been known for years. There are just literally Google Nikki Klein, Google Keith Raniere. The headlines are there. It is not possible for you to interact with these people and not know who they did and what they are. Some of them 100% guilty of by a court of law. Numerous people coming out, witnesses, victims coming out saying this stuff, and others brought up in that trial with lots of evidence that they were involved as well. And I mean, what more evidence do you need than these people literally still defending these actions? I mean, it's done. It's done for them. Okay, Groomer, my ass. Okay, Groomer, you motherfuckers.
They just want you to believe that there's nothing weird about hanging out with people like that. That's like to Matt's earlier or other Matt's earlier point about like they're like, you know, there's a it's a gotcha question. But it's like, no, like guilt by association is their only real sort of like defense of this. Like you can hang out with basically anybody for any reason as long as you're not technically doing whatever crime that they're doing. And you can't be judged for making that decision. It's, you know. It's the erosion of people's like sense of decency for sure, especially on the judgment side.
That was pretty epic, Binder. I should say your tweets are like making waves. I've had multiple people like in my life some people who don't know we work together and some people who do being like, wow, Binder's killing them, basically. So good work with that.
Binder, do you think James Lindsay regrets being unbanned from Twitter?
Oh, he's these guys. That's the thing too. Like
we gotta save it for the fun half. We gotta save it for the fun half.
We'll save it for the fun half. But also scam economy on Sunday. We're gonna be talking about BlockFi, the latest crypto lender to go under, and their story is specifically funny because SBF actually came in, saved them, gave them a line of credit, and then they turned around and gave a loan to SBF's Alameda Research, his crypto lending, his crypto hedge fund, and then the whole thing imploded. And it's just a lot of fun. That's one's a lot of fun. That'll be on Sunday, scameconomy.com and on the YouTube channel. And then tonight, I will be on a new show called The Leftist Mafia with Oluyemi Olorun, and I will learn how to pronounce her name correctly tonight, Illuminati, David Dole of the Rational National, Mike Figueredo of the Humanist Report, Lance of the Serfs. It is an all-star leftist panel, plus me. And it'll be fun. Tonight, 8:30. I think it's going to be streaming on YouTube, on the Humanist Report's channel, and on Twitch on either the Serfs or the Rational National's channel. Just I'll tweet it out when I know. So follow me on Twitter, at Matt Binder.
Branding, what's happening over on the discourse?
Well, we will also be talking about the developments in the SBF, I don't say case yet because there's no case, but happenings. And also, one of my co-hosts, John, was unfairly maligned by a left-wing YouTube account. So we'll be talking about, I guess, the new beef between John and Jimmy Dore.
Oh, can't wait for that.
You classify Jimmy Dore as a left-wing YouTube account?
I mean, I like to, you know, describe people how they describe themselves.
I like to call that channel the artist formerly known as TYT Comedy, but, you know, you know, have at what you will.
He just wants everyone to know that he does not support the Democrats in any way, and okay, that is, and that's what, you know.
It sounds like he supports it. I don't know. You have to see.
He was very offended by that, assertion.
All right. Well, 646-257-3920. Apparently, Kanye is on Alex Jones's show right now
with old like balaclava.
Yeah. No face not being shown, saying I like Hitler multiple times. So fun for the whole family. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Oh, yeah. Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. Back, 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 back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back. Back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy, back. And the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, 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 back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman.
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar! What a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them. Just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
I see white people doing drugs. They look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter. Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
Let me see.
out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on. Fuck them. Things I do for the bigger game plan. By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price of blasphemy around here.
I am in total.
Pussy.